Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Although the 2012-2013 Action Report finds the number of immunizations in San Luis Obispo County has generally been increasing since 2005, it also demonstrates a growing rate of parents opting to take personal belief exemptions for their children, almost twice that of the statewide average. A number of diseases once controlled through immunizations are beginning to reemerge throughout the country. In California, over 6,000 cases of whooping cough have been reported already this year. The state has far exceeded last year's total of number of cases that exceeded over 2,500. How can we protect communities from this deadly disease while still addressing parent concerns for their children? Are immunizations safe? Can they cause more harm than good? My guest today will address some of these concerns, and I'm joined by Dr. Penny Borenstein, the County Health Officer for San Luis Obispo County, and Dr. Mike McNerney, a pediatrician with Patterson and Tedford Pediatrics and a commissioner with the First Five of San Luis Obispo County. Today's show is live, and you can be a part of our discussion by calling in with your questions or comments. And I encourage you to call us at 781-3875. Also, just a note to make sure your comments get on the air, please call in early. We want to make sure that we don't run out of time for your questions. Again, that's 781-3875. And Drs. Borenstein and McNerney, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
So let me start with, you know, just kind of the, you know, when we talk about immunizations, you know, as I was doing some research for today's show, one of the things I was amazed with was that a fully immunized child will receive about 14 different vaccinations and about 26 injections at some time before they're 2 years old. And so, you know, you have people that say, is that necessary? And, you know, so are immunizations necessary?
Well, obviously, you're asking someone who comes at this with I wouldn't say it's a bias. It's the science tells us that absolutely immunizations save lives. We had 10 infant deaths in the state of California 4 years ago from whooping cough. Now, why do you need so many shots to protect against that? That's right. Another whole conversation about how young children, it takes a while to build up the immunity and such, but the diseases that we protect against are important. We've increased life expectancy tremendously by virtue of introducing these vaccines into our routine of medical care over the past century.
You know, somebody once said that the fear about the vaccines now is kind of growing out of its success, in that we've come so far with vaccines that a lot of people today don't fortunately remember some of the illnesses the vaccines are vaccinating against because we haven't had them.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Today's parents, you know, and the generation of 20 to 40-year-olds, roughly, have not seen a single case of measles, have not seen whooping cough, have not seen tetanus, polio, smallpox, things that used to kill people in extraordinary numbers. To an extent, not being aware of how these sometimes seemingly, routine childhood illnesses. I had chicken pox when I was a kid. Why do we, you know, protect against that? It's unknown to many people that even some of these childhood illnesses that were common killed a lot of people. And if we let them get out of control, we'll do so again.
I would say that vaccines probably are the most important medical advancement that we have made ever. And, you know, the one thing that keeps people living longer, it's having vaccines around to keep these diseases from killing children and killing people. Like you were saying, sort of nobody knows what it's like to have polio. If we could go back in the time machine 50 years ago and you see pictures of when Dr. Salk came out with his oral polio vaccine, there are moms lining up around the corner just to get it because, you know, getting a vaccine meant my kids can go outside in the summer and they can go to the pool and they can be around other children when there's these big polio outbreaks. So it's really, like you said, been a victim of its own success. We don't see these anymore. People don't understand what these diseases can do. You know, as a lot of us say in the medical community, at least in pediatric community, it's sort of like how many children are going to have to start dying again before people really start to understand how important vaccines are for them.
There's an expression about herd immunity. What is that? What is herd immunity?
So spelt H-E-R-D, just right. Like it sounds.
Right.
You, within the herd or within a community, you need to have a certain level of vaccine coverage in order to prevent person-to-person spread. So for most vaccines, that's in the 80 to 90% range, that if you have that many, that proportion of your population covered with the vaccines, then it's more difficult for the germs, the organisms, to find someone who's not immune and to be able to pass it on to the next person.
To become epidemic?
Yes. Yes. And so the importance of achieving herd immunity is to keep the levels of these diseases low. But I have heard from a number of people that, you know, if you think about it, so what's the big deal if my kid's not vaccinated?
Right.
10, 20%, you said, and
right.
It still will be relatively okay. But, you know, the further we decrease the vaccination levels, the further we get away from achieving herd immunity, the more likely it is that we will start to see these diseases again.
And I'm a very visual person, and so the way I explain to my parents is just think of a big herd of cattle, and there's one little cow in the middle. Everybody around you is vaccinated, so that one little person in the middle isn't going to have the bugs actually get to them. So if you can look at it from that point, you say, well, herd immunity is really good because the more people that get vaccinated, the more people who are vulnerable, like folks that can't get the vaccine or the very young who haven't gotten enough vaccine to be protected, they're the ones that are going to be protected because the population around them is protected.
How does the vaccine work? You talk about the very young and multiple vaccines. So the reason for multiple vaccinations for children.
So, again, I sort of explain it to folks. You know, the minute your child is born and they clamp that umbilical cord, all the antibodies that mom had given that baby when he or she was inside of them are going to disappear by around 6 months of age. And so if mom's had chickenpox before or measles and mumps or rubella, that baby is protected because mom has the antibodies, which are the, you know, the germ fighters, to cross the placenta and take care of that baby in that first 6 months. We start vaccines routinely at 2, 4, and 6 months because the vaccine has it works in a way that it will prime the immune system slowly. It's just a little bit of antigen that you get in each vaccine. But the goal is to get those three vaccines under your belt before you turn 6 months so that your immune system actually now is primed and ready to fight its own battles. So that's sort of why we start them so early. And most babies' immune systems just don't react to the vaccine like big people do. It's a lot different. Their immune systems are naive. They don't recognize germs like we do. And so it doesn't create that robust of an immune response, which gives you the antibodies that you carry for the rest of your life to fight those bugs.
What about the individuals that say if the child is being breastfed, it's still receiving some kind of immunity from the mother?
It is. It's receiving more of a topical IgA immunity, which is good for your gut, good for sort of, you know, the surface bugs that attack you in your GI tract or in your oral pharynx, your mouth and nose. But it's not the kind that get typically into your bloodstream that are going to protect you against, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, polio, pneumococcus, you know, those are the bugs that we're really targeting.
Okay. We have a question or comment from a caller. Stephanie, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, did you have a question or comment?
Yes. You guys were talking about herd immunity earlier.
Yes.
But I know there are a lot of parents out there that are allowed to still put their kids in school but opt out of vaccinating the kids, the required vaccinations. So why are, you know, they're putting my kids at risk. Why are they allowed to do that?
That is an excellent question. So actually, there has been some change in the law that's important for listeners to know, because as I was saying, the number and the percent of people who have been opting out, as you call it, or signing a form that says personal belief exemption. I don't believe in vaccinations. I believe they're harmful. I believe whatever I believe, and I'm entitled to my beliefs. And all I had to do was check a form and say that, and school would say, okay, you're in. Beginning of this year, January 2014, a law went into effect whereby now a family has to have a conversation and get educated with their pediatrician or their other medical provider to understand what they are saying no to. Many times, families who maybe are a little less organized or were away for the summer and kindergarten crept up on them, and they would show up first day of school and be told, no, we have to see your immunization record. Otherwise, you can't come in. They'd say, oh, my gosh, I can't get that done. You know, well, someone would say, well, here's a form. You just check a box and says, okay, well, I don't want to do the vaccinations. And so a lot of parents were not doing it out of convenience. And probably just as many out of actually opposition to it. So with this change in the law, at least the hope is that families will be forced to make an educated decision about what that means to have your child unvaccinated, what it means to you, and as the caller was pointing out, what it means to the community at large to allow a possible carrier or vector or, you know, infected child into the classroom and all the other children who may have also had their families choose not to vaccinate being exposed. I just want to say one other thing about that law, which is an important factor and has been used on occasion in this county and elsewhere. If there is an outbreak of disease in a school, children who have not received the vaccinations can be put off of school until the outbreak runs its course for their own protection as well as others who are unvaccinated.
And if they actually get one of these illnesses, they might be out of school for months. They could be, you know, ordered to stay at home and stay away from other children. And, you know, what it means to the caller is that if get your kid vaccinated, bring your kids to the doctor and get your shots, and then the kids that are showing up that haven't been vaccinated, your child has a really good chance of being protected against anything they could bring to them.
Yeah, I do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim, did you have a question?
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on.
Oh, okay. Story I heard from my mother was I contracted whooping cough when I was a baby, probably 1950 or 1951, and I would have died except penicillin just came online for a treatment. So I'm not sure you need to get numerous vaccinations for whooping cough if you can knock it out with antibiotic. That's just my comment.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. And we'll address that to Dr. McNerney.
Well,
thank you.
A lot of people sort of have that thinking. Hey, if there's just a treatment for it, then why do I need to be vaccinated? Well, I'll tell you that really there is no treatment for whooping cough antibiotic-wise. If you get whooping cough, we can give you an antibiotic, but the hope is that you won't be spreading it. It's not going to shorten the duration of your illness very much. It's just going to hopefully keep you from giving it to other people. And so that means the treatment of whooping cough is largely supportive. We try to give IV fluids, support you with your respiratory tree, because that's really where it attacks. And if you think if an older person gets whooping cough, you're just going to cough. You're going to feel crummy. They call it the 100-day cough. So you're going to spread that germ around for a few months. It's the very vulnerable, the young infants and the, you know, older population that are really going to suffer from getting whooping cough. And I encourage anybody simply to go online nowadays with YouTube and whatnot. You can look and see what it's like for an infant with whooping cough and how desperate they are to get air in. And there is no treatment for that. And that's why these babies die. So, you know, to the caller's point, there really isn't an antibiotic you can just throw at whooping cough, nor any of these other illnesses, which is why vaccination makes the best sense.
And if I could just chime in, as the public health director, of course, prevention is far more effective in avoiding serious illness and mortality and death than is treatment at the other end of the scale.
You had mentioned, Dr. McNerney, that, you know, when it comes to parents opting out of vaccinating their children, you do, as a pediatrician, have parents who express concerns. What are some of the major concerns that parents express to you about vaccinating their children?
Well, probably the most popular concern is, are all these vaccines going to harm my child neurologically? You know, I think we've all heard the autism and MMR correlation. And, you know, they'll often ask me if there's too many shots and is this going to overwhelm their immune system and can they get sick because, you know, you're giving them four shots in a single visit. Those are the biggest concerns. And to the second point, I usually tell them that, you know, your infant on a daily basis runs into more germs on your body, on your friend's body, from their siblings, than they would probably get in all the vaccines we would ever give them. And I think someone sat down, and I think Paul Offit, who is a pediatrician and a champion for vaccines, came up with a number that said if you did the math, the amount of antigen, if you want to look at it, that as a germ in the vaccine, if how many vaccines would you have to give on this on in one day, in one moment, to actually overwhelm your immune system? I mean, it was like 27,000 vaccines at one time. So when you come in and you get four shots, it's really just a drop in the bucket. It really isn't anything that your body can't handle. You know, their sibling coughing in their face with their rhinovirus is going to, you know, be a lot more germs than that kid's ever going to get. As far as the autism controversy, I mean, that's kind of a dead horse. I mean, it's been beaten. It's there's just.
But a lot of people still are concerned, and a lot of people very much believe that.
Yeah, and the only way I can, I was a resident in training at Children's Hospital when the paper, and I put that in quotations, came out from the Wakefield study,
right,
that made a correlation between MMR and autism, and you know, I think many people don't know that Dr. Wakefield, his paper was redacted eventually from the New England Journal of Medicine, which is really hard to do.
Everybody that was involved in that.
He ended up, yeah, well, he was being financed, I guess, by a medical malpractice lawyer. He was, right. He's a GI doctor, and he was trying to market his own MMR vaccine.
Right.
But the problem is, and I remember when I was a resident, this was when the internet was just starting to get going, and this was when people started carrying around, you know, their BlackBerries, and you could get information, and all of a sudden, this perfect storm of social media and information, and in this case, misinformation, just exploded onto the scene, and it took everybody by surprise. It took the medical community by surprise. I mean, it put everybody on their heels. They didn't know how to handle it. You know, nobody's ever been really good at spin and trying to figure out how to put a media fire out. And it's taken, what, 20 years to mm-hmm. put that fire out? But
this
I think
this was in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah. Or 90s. 97-ish. Yeah. But, you know, since then, and unfortunately, people are still sort of reliant on this mass information blitz that we live in. I mean, it's 10-second news bites here and there. It's all over, and you know, it's this sort of massive information that you just can't possibly get through. It's a headline nation that we live in. Everybody just reads the headlines and skips down to the next one and another headline, and they treat it like it must be true because it's there it is in print. Well, it's on the internet, and I have to tell people, don't be doing your research on the at the University of Google, because that's truly going to get you into trouble. And you know, we've since, there's been so much data and research and everything that's been done that actually just has buried that fear that, you know, MMR or any vaccines cause neurological damage. It just doesn't happen. And in fact, some autism in and itself, some very interesting research has been done over the last few years, that a new paper came out in March, I believe, of this year, that really showed autism happens in utero, so it doesn't happen after you come out of the womb. So really, vaccines are not even, you know, in the picture. And I think that's very encouraging, at least as another tool for us to be able to explain to people that vaccines are safe.
We're going to get back to that in just a minute. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org, part of the NPR Digital Network. I'm talking with Dr. Penny Borenstein, the San Luis Obispo County Health Officer, and Dr. Mike McNerney, a pediatrician with Patterson and Tedford Pediatrics and a commissioner for the First Five of San Luis Obispo. We're talking about current controversies in the U.S. regarding vaccine safety. What questions or concerns do you have about immunizations? If you'd like to address them to today's guests, please call us at 781-3875. And we have a call from Charlie. Charlie, are you there?
Yeah, certainly am.
Okay. Go ahead,
yes,
Charlie.
Hi, Claire. As you know, I'm in addition to a radio stuff, I'm also retired a surgeon.
Okay.
Yeah, have you... I'm sure your people have read the book, Dangerous Choices.
I'm sorry.
I have not. What is Dangerous Choices, Charlie?
It's a book. I've read it. It's about people who choose not to immunize their kids and how dangerous this is to the general community.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's, you know, I heard about it, you know, I'd heard about it and I read it a couple of years, 2-3 years ago. And unfortunately, when I'm up here in San Luis today, and I didn't get a chance to check the author, but Dangerous Choices, it's about maybe 150, 200 pages. And it talks about the history of that. And definitely, I would certainly commend that to anybody that's considering not vaccinating. It's the importance of vaccinating. In fact, the dangerous choices, it's not so much the danger to the individual, but it's the danger to the rest of the community for spreading these diseases.
Okay. Good tip about if somebody wanted to do some more research and wanted to look at something other than Google for some more information. Thanks a lot, Charlie.
And I would add to that, too. Paul Offit, has written a book called it's Autism's False Prophets, and that's a very good book as well.
Autism's False Prophets.
Yeah.
Prophets as in the like a prophet or prophet like money?
Prophet like a prophet preaching the dangers of vaccines.
Okay. And so you were talking about some of the newer research about autism, and actually now they're finding that it's looking more likely that this is something that's developed in utero.
So if I can just, autism is a very complicated disease. Mm-hmm. You often hear about it as autism spectrum disorder,
right?
Because the amount of information we know at this point about autism versus what we don't know is pretty
huge.
Small. Yeah. So you know, the fact that there are genetic aspects to it, we know that. We know that they're environmental causes, but we don't know exactly what those
are.
We know that many children who present with autism, as Dr. McNerney was saying, is now known to be caused in utero during pregnancy, as opposed to after birth. What we also know, and I feel very confident in saying this, is that we know that vaccines are not the cause of autism. And that is a hard concept for a lot of people to let go because they have experienced the recognition of the autism in their children or other family members about the same time that they are getting some of these vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very similar to the fact that children sometimes have seizures when they have fever when they're very young. And immunizations, vaccines cause fevers. And so people think, well, the vaccine caused the seizure or the vaccine caused the appearance of autism. That's dangerous territory to, making the mm-hmm. cause and effect mm-hmm. link.
Isn't it also that the age of when you begin to see the symptoms of autism?
Yeah. So now that more doctors are tuned in and community members are tuned in to what autism looks like, and it's often being diagnosed at earlier ages. So you get some of these vaccinations when you're a year old or 15 months old, sometimes a little bit later. And that happens to be around the time that many children are now starting to show signs of autism. We used to, 2-3 years of age is when those signs would really get someone's attention, but there's earlier recognition.
It's usually under 2 years now.
Yeah.
We screen at 18 months and 2 years. And a real savvy clinician can maybe pick up soft signs under a year.
There seems to be so much more appearance of an autism mm-hmm. spectrum.
Yeah, so we could probably spend another whole show,
yeah.
as you
on
know,
that.
On autism. But I guess the take-home message is I know there are books have been written. I know that Jenny McCarthy is a popular advocate for her child's, autism
right.
was
which she claims
was based
was
on vaccines
vaccine
and other
based.
And that
which
child
turned out
was
not to
cured.
Be autism.
Correct.
And that,
Oh, it did?
So,
yeah.
Well, so there's a lot of popular culture that gets people's attention, understandably. It is really very challenging for those of us in the healthcare delivery field we have an uphill battle against what Dr. McNerney was saying is anyone can go on TV, anyone could write a blog, and that kind of information gets as much credence in this day and age as a scientist in the laboratory mm-hmm. doing very, very detailed and mm-hmm. Careful analysis. And then, of course, it doesn't help when a scientist with all the right credentials mm-hmm. comes along and fakes their data.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was, 15 years before that could be unraveled and has done considerable damage to the public's understanding of this issue. But I guess I just want to reiterate, we are not going to, and I am not going to try to convince anyone who has firmly committed their thinking to, I don't care what anyone says, I know that the vaccines caused harm in my child. I'm not going to attempt to dissuade them from that position. But for those who have their minds open and can understand the difference between a whole body of scientific evidence versus some opinion or poorly done and reported research, the bottom line is vaccines are safe.
Okay. And we're going to, we have a couple of calls here. So, Chris, you had a comment?
Yeah, just a couple questions, actually.
Okay.
First, my daughter is almost 2, and my wife is pretty against the vaccinations, and she was never vaccinated as a child. If we were to start vaccinations after the age of 2, Is there additional risks introducing them that late?
It's a good question.
No. You can always start vaccines, and once started, you don't have to restart them. In fact, you know, as you get older, we actually know that you develop some immunity to some of the things that you could have been exposed to vaccine-wise. So, you actually, there's maybe a few less vaccines in our future.
Okay. Which is just to be careful, not a reason to wait,
yeah,
so that you can get fewer shots.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. She's been lucky for 2 years.
Right. And then the other, something that she came across, and I'm not sure that if it's true or not, but there's something called clean vaccines, which is, as I understand it, a vaccine without any preservatives, so that they only last a couple of days on the shelf.
Well, there's preservative-free vaccines in the state of California. When Governor Schwarzenegger was in office, he enacted a law that stated no child under 3 in the state of California can have preservative-containing vaccine. I would say that's fine, great. It makes them more expensive, and the expensive vaccines are definitely a big barrier to actually getting vaccinated. But I don't think there's absolutely no data that supports the preservatives that have been used in vaccines. In fact, quite to the contrary, they cause any kind of harm to any children under 3.
And when you say they're more expensive, Dr. McNerney, are you talking more expensive for the parent, or there are just
people? For everybody.
For everybody.
And
so
for the pediatrician?
They're not.
Vaccines are a huge liability to any pediatric office. You know, we at our office, we have $100,000 worth of vaccine in our refrigerator and freezers. You know, if the power goes out, we eat that. And they're very expensive.
Yes.
And it is, you know, passed on to the parents through their insurance companies, the cost of the single dose vial preservative-free vaccines that you have to have. You know, that's, it is what it is. We make it through it.
Right. Chris, did those answer your questions?
Yeah, and also just wondering if you have any recommendations on resources to convince somebody.
Well, you know, if you're not a conspiracy theorist, you can go to the CDC website, Centers for Disease Control. You can go to immunizenow.org. You can go to the American Academy of Pediatrics website. There's tons of resources that are honest vaccine resources for you to get information from.
And on the more personal front, you can talk to a local pediatrician,
right,
yeah,
who can give you direct information.
Okay, Chris, good luck.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, streaming live at the web at kcbx.org. And I want to remind listeners that according to the United Blood Bank Services, there's a blood shortage this summer. Here at KCBX, we're hoping to help turn that trend around. So we're encouraging listeners like you to donate during the Pint for Pint blood drive, which ends tomorrow. Please give a pint of your blood, and you'll even get a pint of ice cream. How groovy is that? For the rest of the week, which ends tomorrow, United Blood Services will be giving away certificates for a pint of blood to donors at all of their centers and mobile locations from Salinas to Ventura. For details, please visit your unitedbloodservices.org/cc. If you just joined us on Central Coast Voices, our topic today is current controversies about vaccine safety. And my guests are Dr. Penny Borenstein, San Luis Obispo County Health Officer, and Dr. Mike McNerney, a pediatrician in practice here in San Luis Obispo County. We have about 25 minutes left in today's show. There's still some time for your questions and comments. To add your voice to our discussion today, you can call us at 781-3875. And I'm going to take a call here from Nancy, who's been patient. Nancy, are you there?
This is Nancy Reinstein, and I have a PhD in nutrition science, and I'm a registered dietitian. And I have read the book Make Informed Vaccine Decision, and I have read a lot on vaccines, and I'm a scientist. I am totally against vaccines. My daughter, Ellen Reinstein, who grew up in San Luis Obispo and is a lawyer now, she did not vaccinate her two sons. And I think that there's a lot of very educated scientific information on why you should not vaccinate your child. And I was wondering what these doctors think of the book on the vaccines. Make an informed vaccine decision.
Nancy, we could not hear the book that you were referring to. There was a lot of, like, wind noise. Could you say the name of the book again?
Yes, it's called Make an Informed Vaccine Decision.
I'm not familiar with that particular book, but...
It's written by an MD.
So I guess what I would say to the general audience on this topic, as I said before, is I'm not here to try to change minds of folks who have come to very firm conclusions about the benefits versus the risks of vaccines. But I am here as as the public health representative of the county to say that there is very, very robust information available from all of the national and international organizations and scientific experts in the vaccination field that discredit any findings of harm caused by vaccines. And I don't want to get your opinion is something you're absolutely entitled to, but at this moment in time, the evidence is overwhelming that vaccines do more good than harm. And for those who say, you know, I have chosen not to vaccinate my children, that's a decision that you're entitled to make under the law with certain provisions, as we discussed early on. But I can't in good conscience say that because one MD wrote a book with whatever, you know, their conclusions are, that in any way controverts all of the, you know, tens of thousands of studies on this topic.
Well, I've read studies that show the opposite of what you're saying. So I guess there's just different interpretations of what's been done.
Well, what I always encourage parents who have an opinion like you do, which is, you know, fairly steadfast, is to bring me their data. Show me the research. Show me the papers. We'll sit down, go over it together. We'll look at the statistics that support their evidence. But, you know, it seems most of the time that I'll get I read a book by one person, or I've read this article online, or my friend told me about a book. And so, you know, if you truly want to open up this debate, I encourage you to bring that information to your pediatrician's office, sit down with them and show them why what they've been doing for so long is doing harm to the children that they care for.
Okay. And we're going to take a call here from Jennifer. Jennifer.
Yes.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good.
I was just curious why, when I was a kid, I only got a few shots. And now kids have to get a ton of them.
Yeah.
And why, I mean, are there really that many more diseases? Why do they have to get so many more shots?
That's
now?
A really good question.
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, we know a lot more now. Science has sort of caught up. Medicine has caught up. What we knew 40 years ago, 46 years ago, when we had, if you think about, you know, the first real legit vaccine to come out was polio. But polio wasn't the only, virus that could cause harm. Measles was still there, rubella, mumps, varicella, all these other ones. We just didn't have the science to make the vaccines. And so, you know, the learning what we have along the way has allowed us to really pinpoint some of the worst players and to be able to target them in a way that can prevent these horrible illnesses that they cause.
Vaccine manufacturing is difficult. It It's costly. It takes years. You know, we know that the pharmaceutical companies make a lot of profit on many things that they manufacture, medicines and other products. They do not make much money on immunizations. It is hard work. It takes years to grow up a vaccine. If it were easy, we would have a vaccine for HIV. We would have a vaccine for Ebola that people are concerned about now. So it many of the vaccines that have come online in the last years have been in the pipeline for decades. And there may be more, and there may be more concern in the next generation of parents. Now you want me to get how many vaccines? Each one of them, though, does not add to any harmful aspects. Might there be a time, you know, in the future where we're looking at 40 or 50 and, you know, that we start to spread them out differently? Because understandably, a parent doesn't want to subject their newborn baby to 4 and 5 shots. It feels cruel. In another sense, however, to not do that. I would love for you to have on a show like this a parent of one of those 10 lost children from 2010 who did not have the opportunity to have their child fully vaccinated prior to their demise. And I know I sound perhaps a bit of a fanatic in saying, you know, the more the merrier, bring it on, all the vaccines that we could handle. But, you know, it is what has contributed to us being a society that, you know, the average person dies at age 50 versus age 80. I mean, it really is a significant component of that.
Thanks for calling in, Jennifer.
Thank you.
This is Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio 90.1, Cayucas 91.7, Paso Robles to Salinas 95.1, Lompoc and 99.9, San Ynez, Avila Beach, Cambria, and streaming worldwide on the web at kcbx.org. Fear of disease in the U.S. has shifted to fear of vaccines, and some say vaccines have become more victims of their own success. We've been talking about childhood vaccines and some of the controversy and concerns surrounding them, some of the good that the vaccines are doing, and some of the need for vaccines. The voices with me today are Dr. Penny Borenstein and Dr. Mike McNerney. We have about 15 minutes left in this program to include your comments or questions. You can reach us on air to call us at 781-3875. So questions for you, doctors. Do vaccines always work?
Most of the time. Is that a hedged answer? I can't give you. Well, let me give you a good example of a vaccine that sometimes doesn't work. It's the yearly flu vaccine. And there's lots of reasons for that, namely of which flu changes so quickly that by the time they get it to market and get the vaccine made up, sometimes they've got it wrong. And
it's not the right strain, or
like what happened, was it 4 or 5 years ago, they left H1N1 out of it, and then H1N1 happened. And so you get a vaccine that partially protects you, but then you still get influenza. And you know, it's unfortunate. That fuels the fire a little bit. A lot of people who don't like flu shots will say, well, it didn't help me last year. I got the flu, which usually turns out that they just
What about the childhood vaccines, though, the ones that the babies are getting or that our children are getting?
I think that I can't give you direct information.
So I know that the first dose of MMR – or is about 95% protective, which is why when there was an outbreak a while back, the recommendation was to add a second dose before school. The same for chickenpox. The issue with effectiveness is it depends on how many doses you've had. So you may have started a vaccination series and become infected before the child has had a chance to finish the series and be fully protected. There's also a difference between it didn't work at all and it saved a life. So for flu,
you can
for
have
instance,
partial, yes. not necessarily immunity, but you could have.
Right. So you may still become sick with mm-hmm. one of these diseases, but not so sick that it leads to some very bad outcomes.
Yeah.
And that's commonly true, as Mike said, in adults and particularly seniors with the flu vaccine, mm-hmm. And also infants and people with certain healthcare conditions. Their immune systems are not at their peak. They cannot respond completely to the vaccine. And so they may get a milder version of the illness, and some might consider that a failure, but I consider that a success in that a mild disease, you know, is better
yeah.
than a death.
Are there children that shouldn't get vaccines? Do you make a determination with the parent that it's better for the child not to?
Well, there's very few reasons not to vaccinate, but one would be if your child was, you know, had cancer or was undergoing chemotherapy, and there's some vaccines that you just don't want to give them because mm-hmm. it actually would make them sick. You know, I wanted to make a point on what Penny was saying is it seems like we are learning all the time about the vaccines we give. It never stops. We don't ever stop studying how they work and how long they last. It's if you think about modern vaccination, it's a rather young, you know, mm-hmm. It's been in the last 50 years, 60 years that it's
right.
really taken off. But there's people still living that have had those vaccines, and there's still information to gain from them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that vaccine still working? Well, we learned the hard way that your pertussis, you know,
wears off.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't know that, but now mm-hmm. we know it. And so we give that extra booster, and we give them, you know, before they go to junior high, and we give it to all the parents when they have newborn babies. And, you know, it went from being you're going to get it every 2 years to, hey, you're going to get it every time you get pregnant, because that's how scared we are that this vaccine may not protect you and therefore not protect your child. So I think just the way it evolves, we are constantly learning about these and always studying and always getting more information.
You know, I come from a military family background, and I did a lot of international traveling. And so immunizations for us were something that we received a lot of, I think, a lot.
Yeah.
Of.
Your parents were probably ordered to get you vaccine.
Well, we didn't have a choice. Yeah, we did not have a choice. But so those, you know, but I also had friends who contracted polio, you know, so I had friends who lived in lung machines in their, you know, a friend who lived in her lung machine in her living room. So, you know, I still recall that period of time. And it's a different kind of a,
mm-hmm. yeah,
we don't see that.
Yeah. I want to also add back to your question of are they effective and or harmful. So I think we have a tendency in the U.S. and probably the world over to diagnose ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you've heard the term flu bug, which can mean
anything.
From a
I've
stomach
got a flu
virus,
bug,
you
right.
know, my I have, you know,
whatever.
Diarrhea to I've got a bad runny nose.
Right.
And so a lot of time I hear from a number of people, oh, I got the flu shot and I got the flu. Well, you don't really know that was the flu, and unless it was diagnosed by a laboratory, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different illnesses, hundreds of thousands of different viruses can cause things that look and act like the flu, let alone that people call things that aren't, don't look like that. They also call that the flu. And then there's also the aspect of after vaccination, babies sometimes get sick from
Correct.
The vaccine.
Yeah.
Or babies, children, adults, they may have fever, they may have pain, and they, you know, understandably are concerned that that's a sign that the vaccine is harmful. Well, it made me sick. You know, my baby wouldn't lift his arm for a day. That right. couldn't be good. Well, actually, that is. I know it as a parent. I hate it to see my young children getting, you know, these multiple shots and crying potentially, you know, throughout the course of the next day. But I also, as a pediatrician, know that that is a sign that they're working, that the immune response causes the redness, the pain, the fever. And so I would want to make sure that folks understand that those side effects are not the same thing as getting the disease or evidence of harm.
Are the vaccines alive?
There are live virus vaccines.
They're live virus?
Some are. Mm-hmm. The measles, mumps, rubella, and the varicella are the two live vaccines. There's a live virus flu vaccine as well. But when we say live, they're not truly living. They're developed in a way that they cannot cause the illness that they are protecting you from.
Okay.
But they, and that can be done in a lot of different ways. It can be that they can only live in a certain temperature. So they, you know, like the refrigerator, but hate it inside your nose, you know, when you get the flu mist. And so the neat thing about the live virus vaccines is, you know, if you do have a good response from it, you can get a very good immunologic response if your body picks up on it. And because it treats it like it's a real deal. You know, this is, this is a real thing. This isn't just one little protein. That's if they work the first time. If your body doesn't completely ignore the live virus vaccines, which some do. But the other vaccines are not living. They're a image of the disease. They are a protein. They are combined with other things that your body looks at and doesn't like and wants to create protection against.
Okay.
And just to add onto that a little bit, there are exceptions to the rule of law. There are rare cases with someone who is very immunosuppressed, meaning they do not mount an immune response to a vaccine, that they can actually become ill. With chickenpox vaccine is one example. Another example is we used to, for a very long time in this country, use the live polio vaccine. We got to the point in this country where we were seeing 3 or 4 cases of polio a year from the vaccine. Mm-hmm. In immunosuppressed people, so that now it is, you know, universally we use the killed form of the vaccine. Internationally, the live polio vaccine is still in use because it is actually helping to spread immune protection to others by virtue of that live vaccine going through people's systems and potentially picking up a small amount of the virus and causing protection in the next kid over.
Would the parents and their pediatricians know if the child was immunosuppressed before they took the vaccine, or would that be something that came out of taking the vaccine and having that kind of negative response?
Yeah, I think the versions of, you know, significant immunosuppression that we're talking about, and as Mike
really
had said,
minute.
We know, you know, does
you
a child know. Have cancer? Does a child have okay. certain exotic diseases?
Okay.
Does a child, okay. you know, the first time they got a cold as a baby, couldn't get past it, and you know, some lab tests were done to say they do not have an immune response.
Okay.
So pretty much you would know that.
What about immunization for hepatitis B? Infants are given hepatitis B vaccine at birth, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And why is that?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Pitty. Is it more out of the convention before we could really do testing and know, before blood was screened so much that, and I think it's more important in where there's large populations with women who maybe haven't had prenatal care and we just don't know what their hepatitis B status was, that automatically they would get a hepatitis B vaccine to catch those outliers.
That's definitely part of it. And I think, Chris, probably your question comes from, and I've heard this from a lot of people, is, well, hepatitis B is really passed as a sexually transmitted disease mm-hmm. or through needle sharing, you know, right. blood infection. So why are we worried about our babies? Right. I'm guessing that's where your question is right. coming from. Mm-hmm. And the answer is partially what Dr. McNerney said, because one other way that hepatitis B gets passed is from mother to newborn at the time of birth. We do now have, we attempt to have universal screening for the hepatitis B virus in pregnant women so that we can jump, so the, you know, doctor at the time of birth can jump on that and not only give the vaccine, but something else that's even more protective. But the other main reason that hepatitis B has gone to become, has become a newborn or an infant vaccination process is because people stop going to the doctor when they get older. And so over the last three decades, there have been varying strategies to getting this kind of herd protection from mm-hmm. hepatitis, you know, getting a lot of people vaccinated so that it won't be passed on when people start having sex or maybe even use needles. And so the reason to do it in babies is because that's when you have the easiest opportunity to deliver a three-dose vaccination.
So it's really about taking care of them for later in life.
Yes.
Then okay.
Yes, as opposed to trying to get 16-year-olds into a pediatric office over the course of 6 months three times. It's a practical, logistical decision that has been made.
Okay, and is that pretty much used U.S.-wide now?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Okay, well, any final thoughts? We've got about a minute. So anything that we didn't touch on? No?
I would just say from the public health perspective, we did give out some examples of places to get information.
Yes.
CDC.gov is a really good one. You know, the state health department, cdph.ca.gov is another one. And if people want to call our local health department, 781-5500, we are also happy to provide any information that folks have about particular vaccines or in general.
And also there's www.vaccinesafety.edu that has a lot of information about if people wanted to look at vaccine safety as well. And I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Penny Borenstein, the San Luis Obispo County Health Officer, and Dr. Mike McNerney, a pediatrician with Patterson and Tedford Pediatrics and a commissioner with the First Five San Luis Obispo. And to everyone who called in today with questions and comments, thank you for adding to today's show. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. Next week, join host Fred Monroe and his guests. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.